On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the trade deadline is coming, but we have a lot of non-trade news to discuss. Emmanuel Clase placed on the restricted list as part of the investigation into his teammate Luis Ortiz for sports betting. That is not good. We talk about a recent confrontation between Bryce Harper and Rob Manfred in the Phillies clubhouse. We talk about Ryan Sandberg, who tragically passed away this week. Hit a couple of the trades that have already happened. Talk about Ronald Acuna Jr., who is injured again, sadly. And then we say goodbye on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello, and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world whose mothers went to synagogue together this morning. I'm Jake Mitz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And it's not even a Torah reading day? What an odd way to start this podcast on a beautiful Wednesday morning in the heat of the baseball summer.
It is indeed a big day here. We are recording on this Wednesday morning with the trade deadline rapidly approaching, but we're going to be honest with you fine listeners, our wonderful podcast pals, that we're not going to talk too much about trades on this episode because by the time you're listening to this, hopefully more of them have happened. And even more importantly, we have our big trade deadline special, 5:30 p.m. Eastern on Thursday. We'll be reacting to all the moves that we don't yet know about as we record this on Wednesday morning. But more relevantly, we got a good bit of news non-trade related earlier this week that is going to cover the bulk of this episode. So we're going to leave the trades for the special live episode tomorrow that you can watch on YouTube, on whatever social media platform of your choosing should be available. We're really excited about that. But today, Jake, we have a lot else to talk about. So let's get to it. Our opener.
Oh, I was born a gambling man. We have another gambling scandal. Woo! Or at least the continuation of one that we already knew about, as Guardians closer Emmanuel Clase was placed on the restricted list as part of an ongoing investigation that included his still teammate, I guess, Luis Ortiz, a pitcher. He was placed on the same list about a month ago. I believe the date was July 3rd. And this is really bad.
Yeah. And this is a pretty stunning turn of events here. Now, it does sound like, from those who were covering this closely, Zach Meisel, of course, of The Athletic, my good pal in the Cleveland press box, who was in Kansas City over the weekend. Now, this was an interesting time for the Cleveland organization because Tom Hamilton, their legendary radio broadcaster, was in Cooperstown, being inducted, winning the Ford C. Frick Award. That's relevant because Chris Antonetti was in Cooperstown over the weekend, and on his way back, I believe, got this news on Sunday that this was coming on Monday. And that is a stunning, stunning turn of events. Now, as you mentioned, this is the same investigation that was ongoing into his teammate Luis Ortiz. And I think it's also important to know that as this starts to bubble out, as this starts to balloon, you say, oh no, how big is this situation? And you're seeing all this speculation immediately. That's like, oh my gosh, this is some huge, massive network of gambling. MLB went out of its way to immediately say, hey, we do not believe any other Guardians are going to be involved in this. Now, we have to really hope that that ends up being true, or MLB is going to look terrible in this situation, but they are, of course, the ones doing the investigation. The point is, at this stage, we do not have any specific details about what is being kind of investigated, about what Clase was doing. However, if we go back to the Ortiz situation, where specific pitches that he was throwing to start innings were flagged as suspicious, likely our understanding is because of a suspicious amount of betting activity on individual pitches, which is very important because these many, many gambling sites now have these micro bets, which allow you to bet, ball or strike on specifically first pitches of innings. And it sounds like for the Ortiz situation, there were some pitches there where there was an unusual amount of betting activity That's how you get flagged. And somehow that led its way back to Ortiz. If this is exactly the same thing that is happening with Clase, as some people are suspecting, there have already been smart people that have found some compelling evidence that that could be the case. We don't quite know that it is that explicit right just yet.
With Ortiz, there was specific reporting that he was under investigation for this type of activity. We do not know that about Clase. However, we do know that Clase is part of this investigation related to Ortiz. I think it is interesting that that hasn't been spelled out yet, right? There is a chance that Clase's involvement exists in some other function, right? Maybe he wasn't throwing first pitch balls. Maybe he connected Ortiz to the person placing the bets. I'm just completely hypothesizing here. There's also a chance that Clase was participating in this type of behavior. He would not be put on non-paid leave if he was entirely innocent. If he was under let me back that up. If he was simply being interviewed as part of the Ortiz investigation, he wouldn't need to be effectively suspended, right? Put on non-paid leave. You just sit him down and say, what do you know? There is some sort of involvement here, some sort of behavior that MLB wants to remove him from the field of play. We will learn more about that in time. I think before we continue, it is worth establishing Clase as a character here. This Luis Ortiz was a relative unknown, a player who had played for the Pittsburgh Pirates and was probably best known for being involved in the Andrés Giménez, Spencer Horwitz, Blue Jays, Pirates, a three-team trade over the winter. Emmanuel Clase is on a Hall of Fame pace, on a Hall of Fame track. He is a career, I believe, 1.80 ERA. Might be 1.88, but that number is fleeting my brain. He finished third in the Cy Young last year as a reliever. He is simply one of the best relievers of the 21st century, full stop. Okay. His name had been in trade conversations for the last couple of weeks because he is very good and the Guardians are probably not going to make the playoffs. That is not happening now. Now, technically, he can be traded even if he's on leave. The overwhelming assumption and understanding that I've heard from around the league is that he's not getting moved for obvious reasons, because when this investigation is ongoing, whoever acquires him is essentially acquiring a mystery box and is not going to give up anything significant in return. Okay. So that's the Emmanuel Clase, the character. I'm now going to kick it back to you, Jordan Schusterman, to talk a little bit more about what this all means and where we go from here.
Yeah. Again, we're going to keep the focus on this, the scandal itself, because what it means for Cleveland, I think, is going to become much more clear over the next 48 hours. And we'll cover that after the deadline. But specifically for this situation, which continues to grow, it is troubling. It is extra concerning because it is a player that is much more high profile, regardless of the trade deadline implications. This is a pitcher who, as a closer, you know, has the fate of the game in his hands often, you know, and that is now, should we be weighing, oh, this player can impact the game more, and so it's even worse that it's like, maybe that's unfair, but the optics are undeniable, right? I mean, that is the last kind of person that you would want to be predetermining the outcome of any part of the game, right? When we're talking about impacting wins and losses and compromising the integrity of a professional sporting event. But how does this happen? Because when we think about this, and because gambling has become so omnipresent across this industry, across our country, it is easy for people to look and be like, well, of course, it's everywhere. Look, the lineup sponsored by this company. And this is, but what do you expect's going to happen? This is what MLB gets. And in some large macro senses, I think that that's a fair criticism. But what is happening here is we have to think about it a little more simply, right? This is not a situation where, from what we understand, even with the Ortiz, and even if we just extrapolate it and assume that Clase was doing something similar, this is not an example of being addicted to gambling. Okay, now, gambling addiction is very real, and that is, it clearly is relevant in plenty of gambling scandals both related to baseball and not. When we had players suspended for gambling a year ago, five of them, we thought, okay, well, that this is scary. And we had a player, Tucapita Marcano, who was banned for life because he was betting on his own team while he was on the injured list, placing a bunch of bets. And if you want to throw in, oh, what's the other big baseball gambling scandal we've had? Oh, well, Ohtani. Okay, well, yeah, that involved Ipe betting outrageous amounts of money, outrageous, you know, numbers of times. That did seem to be addiction. What this is, very simply, how players clearly have ended up in this situation is because this is a way to make money. Now, whether that's for them, whether that's for someone that they know, whether that's for someone that they know and someone that they know, this is what the investigation is figuring out, right? Who is actually trying to make money from these micro bets, which is clearly a very important character in how we even get here. Because if you put yourself in one of these... Yeah, if you put yourself in Luis Ortiz's shoes, for example, and probably again, big. this is problematic. Yeah, I'm sure shoes are larger than mine. If you think, oh, if he thinks, and again, this is not good. This requires discipline and is very, very bad. But you can imagine if for some reason he thought, oh, all I have to do is spike a ball and I can make X amount of money for me or someone that I know that needs money right now. And how is anyone going to know? It's a ball. I do this all the time. Yeah. If this is someone that does not understand the gravity of the whole situation and maybe doesn't fully grasp the implications of it, it's not hard to see how that's going to happen. Now, you could point to Klaassen and be like, hey, dude, what do you mean? You've made millions of dollars. Why are you doing this? There are so many reasons why someone could be involved in trying to make fast money. And that is what is happening here. We don't fully understand the specifics. That is what this is about. It is still gambling. It is still connected to baseball because the people are the Major League Baseball players. But that is an important distinction I think we have to make.
I think you make a really good point there. I feel like MLB has already uncovered the what here. The what seems to be pretty straightforward and is in the data of the bets that were placed. The why, and really the who, is what we don't know and what the league probably doesn't know yet and is super important in trying to figure out who deserves blame, who deserves punishment, right? And that's not really something I've thought about, but I think you bring that up. That's a really, really good point. Let's briefly talk about...
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned this as well. Not all of these scandals are created equal. It is very easy to say betting, baseball, Ipe and Emmanuel Clase are both examples of this. And in some extent, they are. And I think to a certain extent, they are both representative of the general kind of desensitization of something that is very serious and has real-world implications. Because you turn on any game and it's win $700 in free bets if you give us your credit card, blah, 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 right? And in that way, I think it's similar to like, you know, tobacco or alcohol, right? Where there are many people, more alcohol than tobacco, there are many people who can engage in it responsibly, right? But there are some people for whom they cannot do that. And the omnipresent advertising of it is what makes all of this, you know, possible and present for all of us. However, what happened to Ipe, where he was just, you know, a constant bet button versus a pitcher allegedly deciding to purposefully throw balls in order to make money, in my opinion, on face with the information we have now, those are two very different dynamics that need to be discussed differently, or else you're kind of oversimplifying and whitewashing the specific nuances of each situation.
Yeah, and I think we should give our audience more credit to assume like that they distinguish the difference.
You're smart.
Because also like, remember, the whole point, it's like, oh, well, MLB just swept the Ohtani investigation. That was over in 2 days. There were so many federal age, like the amount of federal investigation. And one of the number one things that happened with all the Ohtani stuff is that for all the gambling that Ipe was doing on college soccer, all of the federal investigation did not at any point reveal that there was gambling on baseball. That is a big difference than the people throwing the baseball pitches being connected to you know, bets being placed of outsized amounts. Again, that is what we are interpreting with the Ortiz situation and all likelihood the Clase situation as well. But the big picture thing, regardless of how it relates to other scandals, right now, the point is, no matter what the specifics are and all the nuance within, the optics remain horrific and troubling. And if betting continues to grow, if micro bets continue to be something that are a temptation for people who are a part of the game, which is unfortunately extremely predictable, then that is what MLB does get for getting this far into this, you know, in some sense.
And I think,
but at the same time, it's still, that doesn't absolve the responsibility of these players who are breaking the number one rule, right? This is the thing that you cannot do. You can go bet on all the other sports all you want, but this is the one thing you can't be involved in. Yeah. And a lot of them do.
They do bet on all the other sports, and that's fine, right? I do think that the micro bets, that dynamic is important to understand here within the specific context of baseball, right? The rise of legal sports gambling since 2018, when the Supreme Court essentially overturned a federal ban. I mean, it's every sport, right? You turn on any broadcast and it's the over-unders are being talked about. And I think that that's okay to a certain extent. Like, there's a line there. Where is it? We can have that conversation as a society. I'm sure we'll figure it out responsibly. I'm sure that'll go well. But the reason that baseball is in a unique situation is because there are simply more things that you can bet on than there are in any other sport by a mile. I can bet on every single pitch. In any baseball game, there are what? 250, 350 individual pitches and moments that I can, you know, press bet. Like, that's huge compared to football. There are just more moments. And that makes, not just more moments, there are more moments that have a relative low impact on the outcome of a game, right? Where a player, allegedly Luis Ortiz, will say, oh, I'll just throw a ball. It's not going to impact the outcome of the game. That's fine. Ball one. Oop, 20K, right? And so we're in a more vulnerable spot as a sport because of how we're structured. Moving forward here with the Guardians, I would say from a baseball tilt, this does change their deadline probably. I think they're less likely to go and buy when you don't have a top three closer in the world available every night. That feels relevant. Were they going to buy anyway? Who knows? We'll never know. It certainly feels less likely now. What this means for this team going forward, I think, is really interesting. I mean, he's a big player and a big asset that maybe they would have traded away for a big return, or they would have. He helps them compete. He was a huge part of them making the ALCS last year as one of the best bullpens in baseball. And it's just a freaking bummer because this guy is super fun to watch pitch. He's a unique player. And to get wrapped up in this is just, man, Cleveland fans, just yikes.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. And unfortunately, today, this podcast has a lot of not so happy news. But I will end on this sad note, which is that this is also, in a very, very basic sense, like extremely sad, right? Like the fact that particularly, I mean, Ortiz too, but whatever the specifics are behind this are, when we get them, are probably not going to make anybody feel any better. Whether this was complete reckless ambition, whether this was someone trying to make money for someone else that needs more money than they do because they're big leaguers, all of it is very, very upsetting. And in Class A's case in particular, just an absolute shame to be on this Hall of Fame track, to basically be the greatest closer through age 27, not named Mariano Rivera ever, and to now probably never pitch again. That sucks. That the fact that any sort of circumstances could lead to that outcome is just awful. So that's not the best note that I want to end a podcast segment on, but I think that is a very basic takeaway amidst all the conspiracies and all of the whoa, what does this mean for baseball and the deadline? It's like, that is just really sad. So on that not so happy note, we're going to take a break. When we return, some even more fun topics, CBA negotiations upcoming. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecue.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. If you enjoyed Gambling Scandal, wait till you hear CBA labor fight in Clubhouse. We need to talk about this. It in the red shorts, standing 6'3", bearded as hell, with 356 career home runs. Bryce Harper. Yeah, fact check that for me.
A little high. Oh, never mind. Really close. 351.
Pretty good, Jake.
Home runs in the, for Bryce Harper. 6'2". 210.
6'2". 210. In the blue button down and slacks and sneakers that are too young for him. Weighing, not going to guess, at 5'11". With teeth like mine, with zero career home runs, Rob Manfred. Who you got?
I mean, it's a great question. If we're talking actual boxing, I like Bryce's chances. If we're talking massive labor fight that will determine the course of baseball history, I'm honestly still not sure who to take here. Because we're heading for one heck of a fight, my friend.
One-on-one, I'm taking Manfred. Okay? One-on-one. Because Manfred is a labor lawyer. That's the whole thing. And I think maybe, you know, the union versus the league, we could talk about that. Harper on Manfred, if we're getting into the nitty-gritty of labor law, I think Rob's kind of got this one. But, you know, that's just me. Okay, so what happened here? What in the world are we talking about? If you don't know what we're talking about,
Rob Manfred, as part of his job, particularly over the last few years, as coming out of the last CBA negotiations, one of the big takeaways that the commissioner admitted publicly was, man, my relationship with these players is not very good. I should probably do something to help improve that, or at least attempt to show an effort to connect with players and become more approachable, become more accessible. And so part of that is that over the course of the season and in spring training, the commissioner pops in. He rolls through. It seems to be a pretty kind of random timeline of when he shows up at different clubhouses, but he does visit with every team over the course of a season, I think multiple times.
Yes, and he will often do it when teams are in New York. That's not the case here. I have multiple times walked into a visiting clubhouse right after Manfred does the, hi, everyone, I'm Rob. And the looks on players' faces is always very funny. Like when you walk right in after that, some of them just totally tuned out for the whole time. And some of them are just like, and you know, not to really dig into this, I'm not sure if Rob Manfred going and talking to the players is making players like him more.
Well, okay, so let's get to this specific case, right? So Manfred has said, like, the reason I'm doing this is like I said, trying to have more of a through lines of communication. Now, you can read that in a lot of different ways. You can read that very earnestly, and you can just read it at face value and be like, yeah, that's probably a good thing. It would probably be a good thing if the commissioner was more accessible the players who play in the league. I think that that is true, right? I think that there is a base level that is better than him just sitting up in the MLB offices and no one ever gets to talk to him face-to-face. I think that that is fine. We can accept that. However, because of the timing, because we understand that the CBA is expiring after next season, it is also very clear that these visits have a purpose, have a political and kind of negotiating tactic, which is if I can talk directly to the players, as opposed to when I'm going to have to get in a room with the union lawyers and start battling it out with them over these things, if I can get the players' ears and if I can give them information that will maybe almost subtly or subconsciously move them closer towards the premises of the next CBA that we have in mind from the owner's side, that would benefit us. And it sounds like the latest attempt to do this did not make certain folks in the Phillies clubhouse who he was visiting especially happy. We have a series of reporting on this latest meeting, first from Hannah Kaiser over at the Bandwagon. We then get a follow-up from Jeff Passan. We get some from the New York Post, from Joel Sherman and John Heyman. The details of this meeting recently, with Manfred visiting the Phillies, became very clear. And the most glaring and notable detail of all of it is what we were referring to at the beginning of this segment, which was that at one point, Bryce Harper and Rob Manfred, quote, according to these reports, stood nose to nose with Bryce Harper telling him to get the F out of our clubhouse. This was seemingly a response to some amount of insinuation or reference that Rob Manfred was making or not making, but probably making to the premise of a salary cap, which we understand is going to be a focus from the owner's side in these negotiations. But that key detail, Bryce Harper telling the commissioner to get the F out.
Yeah.
I mean, all of it, whatever, all whatever it means, that is a pretty notable moment that we are obviously going to talk about on a podcast.
First question, did their noses touch? I think we need to know that. It says nose to nose. I don't think they were like rubbing noses like a high school couple doing PDA. Also, the idea of like Bryce stepping to Manfred in a physical manner is wild. Wild. And how important is this story? Like, what type of impact does it have moving forward? I'm not really sure. I don't really know. But it is newsworthy because a top 10 player in the league and a top 5 influential player of the 21st century told the commissioner to get the F out of our clubhouse. That in and of itself is absolutely bonkers. Now, there's a lot else here. There's Nick Castellanos, who seemed to try to play like peacemaker in a way and play down the tension that was in the room. There's Harper saying the players are not scared to lose 162 games. Him sitting in the corner by his locker, just like holding a bat, waiting, like during this talk, is just an unbelievable image, right? He's just sitting there holding the bat like he's ready to go up to compete in that way. We could go in a lot of different directions here, but I think let's start with the cap as a character, because the cap is going to be the most important discussion point in the upcoming CBA negotiations, almost certainly. To this point, Rob Manfred has not specifically, publicly, like technically advocated for a cap. He has talked around that in so many ways. A number of owners have overtly advocated for a cap, including O's Magna Carta owner David Rubenstein. And I think that it is important to understand the historical context here, where players are just not going to go for a cap. The league has been trying to get one for years. It is the only league that does not have one. It is going to be a central character here. That sets up the dynamic of how these negotiations are going to go. In the last round, and it's not this simple, in the last round, the union was on offense and the league was on defense. And in this round, I think those roles are going to switch a little bit, where the league wants to create change in the system and the players are more content with the status quo than the league is. Now, obviously, the two sides are both trying to pull the situation, the CBA, in their general respective directions. But I think that that is just a fair way to classify how this relationship is going to be. And we can see that this is a quote from The Athletic earlier in the year when Manfred was talking about his strategy of going to go talk to players. Quote, "The strategy is to get directly to the players. I don't think the leadership of the union is anxious to lead the way to change. So we need to energize the workforce in order to get them familiar with or supportive of the idea that maybe change in the system could be good for everybody." Right? He wants change. Why does he want change? Because, well, they want a cap and they want more money flowing into the owner's pockets, right?
But that phrasing is so revealing and so transparent. Revealing. And to say that, like, almost be like, for the league to be like, we need to energize the workforce is like both fascinating and almost backwards, right? Because in theory, so much about this is the union sticking together and then union being on the same page. And so it is one hell of a tactic to be like, no, but we're just going to jump over the union and try and convince them that they want what we want.
And part of the reason that that tactic is inflammatory is because now Manfred can say this is not my intention all he wants. The outcome is to foster a level of discord and disagreement within the union about the cap. And I think that that is savvy in a way, because the Bryce Harpers of the world, like, obviously don't want a salary cap. That makes a ton of sense, right? That's intuitive. The area, at least in theory, where the league can make headway is by convincing the lower salaried rank and file players that a salary cap and a floor would be good for them, because they would then make more money. Now, whether or not that's true, that's a conversation for another day and another podcast. But like, that's what the union is fighting against, is keeping everyone on the same page, everyone together, advocating and arguing for the same things. And so I do think it is interesting that when Manfred goes into these rooms, he is literally trying to like get the players to like want change, to energize the workforce. That certainly reads a little bit differently. Any other thoughts on this? We will have this conversation 1,000 more times over the next year and a half. The general energy right now is no bueno. Like, it's ugly, and it's going to get uglier. Do we lose games? Ask me in a year and a half.
Yeah.
Ask me on March 15th, 2027.
I don't want to talk anymore about the specifics of the labor fight, but if we focus on this event, I will say, as far as something that we will continue to track, because we are still a year and a half from these actual negotiations, Rob Manfred still has a bunch of visits planned, right? He's still, in theory, going to continue to go around to different clubhouses. And I am very curious if this event does lead to more pushback that we either hear about or don't hear about. I don't know if there's any scenario where a team could actively prevent Manfred from visiting. That seems extremely unlikely. But I do wonder if this is an event that could influence the way that those meetings continue to go down moving forward, for better or for worse. Probably for worse, because again, it's just going to get uglier from a negotiating standpoint. But that is the thing that I'm thinking about in the short term, because as far as the actual negotiations, we're just still so far away from that.
Something that happens in these meetings too is the commissioner brings former players that work for him along to kind of create what is a more comfortable environment. And that's, you know, that's been like CCE, that's been Mark DeRosa, that's been Rajai Davis. And I think that if I was Rob Manfred, my next meeting would be something of a home game. I would pick a pretty easy one, a team with a lot of young players and no veterans who are going to stand up and yell at me, go to the Nats clubhouse, right? Like talk to the A's maybe. Right?
A's don't have a lot of vets. Like, yeah.
Find a team that where no one's going to get mad at you and just kind of roll back into it slowly. This is the team that would get contentious. The Phillies they're just vets.
Oh yeah.
When they were in New York last weekend,
so true.
They have the roster up on the wall and they have everyone's service time. It's like they have like six or seven guys over 10 years of service time.
They didn't have, until Otto Kemp, they didn't have a rookie or a major league debut for the first 2 months of the season. Yeah. Like, they are one of the oldest and most experienced teams. So that is a good point. I know that, you know, Harper is the main character in Castellanos, but it is true. It is representative of a roster that is not going to take any crap from the commissioner. Whereas there are plenty there, as you just mentioned, some of those other teams where everybody's pre-arb and nobody's made any money. That is a very different crowd. And so that's the thing. There's all these different like fights within the fight that are going to be uncovered and discussed. And this is an interesting dynamic that played out in truly fascinating fashion that I think we will always kind of remember about Bryce Harper, no matter where we go from here.
Me and Rob Manfred both told to get the F out of my clubhouse. Last point on this before we take a break. Jordan, do you know who the Phillies union rep is?
No.
Garrett Stubbs. This never would have happened if Garrett Stubbs was in the big leagues and not in Lehigh Valley. Bring Garrett back up.
I assume this someone else is covering for him, but maybe not. I don't know how that works. That is interesting. But anyway, If you have more thoughts on that, again, we'll keep talking about CBA. Unfortunately, that will be a main topic over the next year and a half. But for now, we will leave it at nose to nose. We're going
to
take a break.
Nose to nose.
When we return on Baseball Barbcast, some more news. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the end of this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Let's fly around the league. We got some sad news this week as Hall of Fame second baseman Ryan Sandberg passed away on Monday at the age of 65. He had been diagnosed with cancer last year, and I think the people closest to Ryan Sandberg knew that this was maybe coming. What a phenomenal career. What a life. He is someone who, to be frank, as two kids who grew up on the East Coast in the 2000s, are not intimately familiar with Ryan Sandberg. I went and listened to Mike Farron, friend of the program, Uncle Mark, and Kevin Franzen talk about Ryan Sandberg and what he meant to them yesterday on Power Alley on SiriusXM. Highly recommend that listen. And one of the thing that I don't think I fully appreciated about Ryan Sandberg is the cultural status he held and holds in the city of Chicago. And Farron really put this in an interesting way. Like, Sandberg filled a kind of a gap in Chicago sports between sort of the end of Walter Payton and the beginning of Michael Jordan, where for a very specific time, he was the guy. And because the Cubs were broadcast on WGN all the time, he was a national superstar and a regional icon in the Midwest and someone who had a really large impact on Chicago Cubs fans and on the city of Chicago. He is one of the greatest second basemen of all time, full stop.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that Chicago-specific context is really important. And I mean, if you just strictly look at the stats and just the career trajectory, it's also very compelling as someone who was drafted by the Phillies, traded right after he debuts. And for 2 years, it looks like it's like, all right, we got this nice player, really good defender. Like, what a good player to kind of have around on your team. Like, was going to be a fan favorite. 1984, just absolute monster breakout, wins the MVP. But you're right, that timing, I think it speaks so much about Chicago and Cubs fans in general, because let's be honest, the Cubs were not winning that much over those yeah. years. Now, I know, of course, historically, the Cubs were not winning much over the 20th century, but truly over that time, it's not like, you know, they had that few runs to the NLCS, but he was just this face of a team that meant so much to so many people. And we know this now too. Like, this is, we're really feeling it this year because the Cubs are awesome again. Like, that is just such a special fan base and such a special city. And to star for the Cubs is such a big deal. And to do it for 15 years, you can understand why he made such a big impact on so many people. And that is just if he was an awesome second baseman with nearly 300 homers and 300 steals and 400 doubles. Like, by all accounts, also an unbelievable human being who goes on to become a manager in both the Cubs minor league system, and he manages the Major League Phillies kind of during their rebuild. And that kind of gave him another second wind in the baseball world where people got to be impacted by Ryan Sandberg. Yeah. And I think that is the other cool part about his story, and also what is so sad about losing him at age 65 is because he was clearly someone that was still making a big impact on people late in his life.
And this was a point that, you know, Farron and Franzen made. Just very quiet, very humble guy, kind of an introvert. We joke all the time, Jordan, like we talk about Jim Palmer and Barry Larkin as unique in their desire as Hall of Famers to do the broadcast grind, right? Palmer going on the road, how old is he? Like in his 80s, right? If you look across who's on broadcasts, it's usually not Hall of Fame level players, right? And if you look into dugouts, who are the managers? It's you or the coaches. It's usually not Hall of Fame level players, guys who made a ton of money, because you know what? They can simply afford to sit on their butts. Ryan Sandberg, after being inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2005, goes to manage an A-ball as a Hall of Famer, riding the buses, doing the grind in an era when doing low A, high A, I mean, that, those are long rides.
Midwest
man.
League, man. Midwest like, League. He managed Peoria for 2 years, Tennessee in 2009. Yeah.
Right. Like, he wanted to manage, coach in the big leagues. He was told that was the path. He said, great, let's go. And he was in the minors for like a long time. Ends up being the big league manager with the Phillies kind of towards the beginning of the rebuild, the end of the crumbling of that era of Phillies baseball. Things didn't really work out there. But you talk about anybody who is, you know, intimately connected with Ryan Sandberg, and they have nothing but phenomenal things to say. So rest in peace to him. Thoughts go out to his family and to all the Cubs fans who loved watching him.
Let us talk about a couple trades and then one more somber bit of news before we say goodbye. Again, by the time you listen to this, I'm sure there are far more interesting trades that have happened. But because these have actually occurred and we do have some thoughts, let's hit them quickly. The Orioles, although they are playing much better, continue their sell-off as they deal Sir Anthony Dominguez to the Toronto Blue Jays. The Blue Jays bullpen stats are actually really good. Like, if you would look at the names beyond Jeff Hoffman and be like, oh, they must be 17th in ERA and, you know, 18th
Fluharty in strikeout gang, baby. Rate.
Like, no. Yeah, Fluharty and you know, Brendan Little, man. Like, they do. Yariel Rodriguez has been having a good season, but they still viewed it as an area where they could add. And Dominguez is having a much better season than Gregory Soto. I know they're both kind of lumped together because they've been on the same teams and they both throw really hard and they both don't throw a lot of strikes. But Dominguez is getting a lot of strikeouts. I mean, he's walking a ton of guys too this year, but you can see the upside with him for sure.
Yeah.
And just like with the Soto one with the Mets, just makes a ton of sense. And I like the prospect that the Orioles got back. Juwan Rotz Brown is exactly the kind of guy they should be targeting, an upper level pitcher that could pitch in the big leagues next year.
Fun dynamic here is that the Orioles were hosting the Blue Jays for a doubleheader, and Dominguez was traded in between the games. He did not pitch in the first game for the Orioles. He did pitch in the second game for the Blue Jays against the Orioles on a day where he woke up as a member of the Orioles, spent game one in the Orioles bullpen, spent game two in the Blue Jays bullpen, which is right next to it, goes into pitch, and you can see on the jersey that the jersey was made so quickly that his eight, he wears number 48. The eight is very clearly upside down as the smaller circle of the eight was on the bottom and not the top. Sir Anthony Dominguez. And then Juwan Rotz Brown, who was traded for Dominguez, went from the, I believe, the Fisher Cats to the Chesapeake Bay Sox, right? And so he switched clubhouses as well. Very odd, very bizarre, very rare. Three other trades will fly through them.
Wait.
Raise a question. Go ahead.
Sorry. I just love the idea that they only made this trade to like save the logistics of having to send a player to like the West Coast. This will save us a couple hundred bucks. Let's just do this now. Like, why? Why? Because, by the way, there are going to be a lot of logistical messes over the next 48 hours because nobody's playing on Thursday. That's a travel day for most teams. So I could see a situation where that's not why teams are making trades, but the timing is going to be impacted by the logistics there. Anyway.
Quick aside here. My favorite trade deadline logistic mess is, I've told you this, right? What James Wood told me when he got traded. You remember this?
No, I don't.
Okay, so James Wood is with the Padres, right? He's playing for Lake Elsinore in the California League. They get on the bus to drive to play a series, I believe in San Jose, which I think is like a 7-hour drive. They get on the bus, 30 minutes into the ride, James Wood looks at his phone and realizes he's getting traded for Juan Soto. He can't get off the bus. He can't have the bus turn around because the trade's not official yet, right? So, like, it's reported and everyone knows it's happening. The team can't acknowledge it officially yet because in a trade, in the Juan Soto trade, there's a lot of boxes to check, right? So he just has to ride all the way to San Jose, or maybe it was Fresno, 6 hours knowing he's no longer on the team. And you can imagine James Wood, our quiet king, sitting on the bus being like, oh, yeah, no, it's okay. I'll just, no, it's fine. All the way.
I'll drive back. It's not a big deal.
It's fine. So he goes, Fresno or San Jose, flies back south to get all of his stuff in Lake Elsinore, packs it up, and then goes and joins the Nats organization on the East Coast. So remember, this is a very chaotic time for some of your favorite players. Three more trades. Rays acquire Nick Fortes from the Marlins in exchange for Matthew Etzel. The reason that they made this deal, the Rays, is because they traded away their catcher. Danny Jansen goes to the Brewers in exchange for Jodher Arellano, which is a name that I have never said before in my entire life.
Yeah, that's tough. You really just stepped into that one because I did specifically ask around how to pronounce it, and I believe it is Jodher Arellano. But you did a great job. That was a great effort.
No, I didn't.
But anyway, the Brewers bring in Appleton, Wisconsin's own Danny Jansen for some catching depth. And then the only other trade to mention is the Tigers getting Chris Paddock and Randy Dobnak. Oh my gosh, Randy Dobnak back in the news. Good for him. They traded Twins, trading them to the Tigers for a catching prospect, Enrique Jimenez, who sounds pretty interesting. But Tigers need arms. Reese Olson is out for the year. Jackson Jobe out for the year. And I know they're playing a little bit better this week, but the Tigers need pitchers of all kinds. I expect them to continue to add that. Jake Mintz, before we say goodbye, we finish on, once again, not the most fun note. Ronald Acuña Jr. is injured. Ronald Acuña Jr. has been placed on the injured list with right Achilles inflammation. That is better than a right Achilles tear, but it is not good for someone that has already had multiple ACL tears and who we were finally like, Ronald's back. I don't care how much the Braves stink. I get to watch Ronald play baseball. And now we don't, and that sucks so much for him, obviously, and it sucks for us who really don't have a reason to tune into the Braves now for the rest of the season. This nightmare Braves season continues, and I just really hope, it sounds like how they handled this is really troubling, where he reported to the team, said he was not feeling good, but he also was feeling guilty about missing time, and so he wanted to play. Why they let him play is just inexplicable and terrible and reckless. I really hope this is not a super duper long-term thing, and I hope we see him play baseball again, but I kind of doubt we're gonna see him again this year. Yeah. I mean, we'll see.
I need Ronald Acuña to have a normal injury, like a really low impact injury. Can we get this guy like turf a bug toe? Bite?
Can we just like kind of just something with ingrown toenail? I would even take just like hamstring. I know a lot of lower body, just like something where it's like, oh, okay, he'll be back in a little bit. Oh, he turned his ankle. Okay, it's fine.
Bunny.
Can we not be doing these really dramatic injuries? Like, I really don't. Just like he's like a headache. Come on. I want Ronald to play baseball. I really, really, really do. And this
Remember
would
warts?
Really suck if he's
Remember
out
you
for a really
kid?
Long time.
Get the warts frozen off. You ever have
yeah,
to do that?
That's disgusting. What a way to end the pod. Thank you for that image.
Very quickly,
Ronald, we wish you the best. Yeah.
Before we say goodbye, great show. Good job. You can email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. You should watch our live show. Tomorrow is gonna be sweet. Really excited about this. Not fake excited, like legitimately actually excited to essentially stream, which we don't get to do a lot and we love doing. And the timing of this is going to be spectacular and sensational. So make sure you tune in for that. The link is already live on YouTube. You can watch there. You can watch on Twitter and X and Facebook and see our beautiful smiling faces chat about ball. Before we go, Jordan, I just wanted to say I moved. I don't live in New York anymore.
You did.
In D.C. now, which is pretty sweet. Wife going to grad school here, and I just, after living in a place for 8 years that meant a lot to me, I wanted to say goodbye and thank you to all the people that make New York swell. And just very quickly, a quick story about, I don't know if I told you this, but so I, as you know, I coach Little League in the city, and easily the most emotional moment for me was kind of saying goodbye to all the Little League kids who I'd spent, 4 or 5 years coaching. And I just weeped, saying goodbye to these kids because I'd been with them since they were like 6 or 7 to when they were like 11 and 12. And I had this moment, it was really, really kind of beautiful, where it's a beautiful summer day and I went over to the practice and it was just like, they were playing, there were no coaches there. couple parents just running a loose practice, and just to see how much baseball now matters to these kids becoming young teens, becoming adults. Like, that's the point, man. And it was such a fulfilling moment for me. And I just wanted to kind of share that story to advocate for people. Like, if you're thinking, hey, I love ball, should I coach? Should I like be around the game? Yes, do it. It is so rewarding. It changed my life. And I want to say thank you to all the people involved with Harlem Little League and the Harlem Hellfighters for making me love the sport again in a new and different way.
Amen to that. And yes, I admire all the work that you've done with that league. And I hope you continue to find ways to do that in DC in some form. And look forward to hearing more about that very soon. I'm sure that's already very much in the works, and I look forward to hearing about it.
Me and your brother? Me and your brother coaching a little league team together?
Big Dave. He's already teaching, man. He's already in that space. Maybe he can
call me up.
He can recruit some kids for you. All right. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz, TJ Brassel for producing. Thank you all so much for supporting us. And we will see you on Thursday for the trade deadline. Bye.